participation into the Dharma. Thanks especially to those of you who have put aside an entire day to return to silence. As the Tanto pointed out this morning, it's very easy to get lost in the hurly-burly of our everyday lives, kind of lose track. And to take a day in the midst of the, especially in the midst of the Shila Ango, to become quiet again is of enormous value to ourselves and to others. This morning, we'll take a look at a koan. This will be case number 2 in the Wu Men Guan. It's the Mu Meng Kan. Bai Zhang's Fox. The case reads, once when Bai Zhang gave a series of talks, a certain old man was always there listening together with the monks. When they left, he would leave too. One day, however, he remained behind. Bai Zhang asked him, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the far distant past, in the time of Kashyapa Buddha, I was head priest at this mountain. One day a monk asked me, 'Does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not?' I replied, 'Such a person does not fall under the law of cause and effect.' With this, I was reborn 500 times as a fox. Please, say a turning word for me and release me from the body of a fox." He then asked Bai Zhang, "Does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not?" Bai Zhang said, "Such a person does not evade cause and effect." Hearing this, the old man immediately was enlightened. Making his bows, he said, "I am released from the body of a fox. The body is on the other side of this mountain. I wish to make a request of you. Please, Abbot, perform my funeral as for a priest." Bai Zhang had a head monk strike the signal board and inform the assembly that after the noon meal there would be a funeral service for a priest. The monks talked about this in wonder. "All of us are well. There is no one in the morgue. What does the teacher mean?" After the meal, Bai Zhang led the monks to the foot of a rock on the far side of the mountain. And there, with his staff, he poked out the body of a dead fox. He then performed the ceremony of cremation. That evening, he took the high seat before his assembly and told the monks the whole story. Huang Bo stepped forward and said, "As you say, the old man missed the turning word and was reborn as a fox 500 times. What if he had given the right answer each time he was asked a question? What would have happened then?" Bai Zhang said, "Just step up here closer and I'll tell you." Wang Bo went up to Bai Zhang and slapped him in the face. Bai Zhang clapped his hands and laughed, saying, "I thought the barbarian had a red beard, but there is the red-bearded barbarian." Wu Men's comment: not falling under the law of cause and effect. Why should this prompt 500 lives as a fox? Not evading the law of cause and effect. Why should this prompt a return to human life? If you have the single eye of realization, you will appreciate how old Bai Zhang lived 500 lives of a fox as lives of grace. Wu Men's verse, not falling, not evading, two faces of the same die. Not evading, not falling, 1,000 mistakes, 10,000 mistakes. Bai Zhang, whose Japanese name is Hyakujo, his dates are 720 to 814 of the Common Era, was a pivotal figure in our lineage. He was Dharma heir of Mazu, that's Vaso, a Dharma brother of Nanchuan, that's Nansen, and father in the Dharma of Wangbo, Obaku, and the Dharma grandfather of Linji, Rinzai. He is the direct ancestor of two of the five houses of Chinese Chan. So we're dealing with one of the heavyweights here. This is a huge koan. One could easily give a dozen teisho on it and not run out of material. So for today, I will confine myself to just one aspect and leave the rest for some other time. Most koans are direct, if abbreviated, accounts of the sayings and doings of the great Chan masters of ancient China. This one's a little bit different. The first part of it presents as a kind of ghost story. A former abbot from not just long ago, but from an entirely different kalpa, a world cycle, the time of Kashyapa Buddha, questions Bai Zhang. And since he had been the abbot, he would have taken the same name, that is, the name of the mountain where the monastery was. Bai Zhang means 100 leagues. So we have Bai Zhang the elder questioning Bai Zhang the younger, but they are not separate. Bai Zhang asks Bai Zhang, does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not? Bai Zhang the elder answered his questioning monk, such a person does not fall under the law of cause and effect. And as a result, he had to spend 500 lives as a fox. So I guess that he was wrong. And he wasn't enlightened enough to escape retribution. It would appear that the law of cause and effect has a very long arm indeed. The Buddha himself suffered various illnesses and misfortunes, and being the Buddha, he was able to say exactly what he did in which former life that merited his current suffering. Well, if the Buddha did not avoid the consequences of his actions, that doesn't say much for our chances. But still, the heart of this koan is the question, does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not? Cause and effect. Our lives are dominated by cause and effect. All our cautionary tales, morality tales, and urban legends are about cause and effect. If you do evil, evil will catch you out. Good is rewarded. Sometimes that seems more like wishful thinking. How many times do we see or hear of someone who has committed all sorts of crimes, and yet who lives what appears, at least, to be a life of peace and plenty? Do they know something we don't? Have they attained to some kind of freedom? I think that's why we're fascinated by villainy. The bad guy seems to have a kind of freedom. Hence our secret envy of the successful con man, the successful thief. Many people have a powerful fascination with magic, spells and incantations that seem to violate the laws of nature. And then there is the enduring popularity of Superman, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, unconstrained by the law of gravity. Wealth is often equated with freedom. I remember hearing years ago a radio interview with a Texas oil millionaire, during which the interview rather naively asked him, wasn't his wealth really a burden? The oil man replied, I don't believe there's any problem connected with it at all. You can do what you want to. And yet we are told the law of cause and effect, the law of karma. These terms are often used interchangeably, but they're not quite the same thing, is as precise and unforgiving as the law of gravity. The whole business of cause and effect was the fundamental insight and one of the first teachings of the Buddha. He presented it as the famous 12-step cycle, the wheel of samsara, the cycle of dependent origination, or better, interdependent origination. It describes step by step how the suffering self is perpetuated through the eons. If at any point that cycle is interrupted by the extinguishing of a single step, the cycle ends. This is what is commonly called nirvana. The cycle is traditionally presented as a wheel rolling along, each point on the rim touching the ground in sequence. While many books have been written on the subject, a very quick and incomplete summary of the 12 steps would go something like this. Step one is ignorance. This refers particularly to ignorance of the Four Noble Truths and of the true nature of cause and effect. Ignorance leads to step two, volitional action, that is, actions that stem from ignorance. The analogy often given is that ignorance is akin to the state of being drunk, and volition, the actions of the drunkard. This volitional action leads to step three, consciousness. This is the as yet incoherent sense of something separate and unique, something that constitutes a self apart from everything else. This amorphous consciousness is then subdivided in step four into mind and body. These are the specific forms taken by the self and include the five skandhas, aspects of the human psychophysical organism, and a further division and separation, which leads to step five, the six sense organs. These are the so-called gateways through which we perceive the me and the not me parts of reality, and which leads to step six, sensory contact, the interaction between what has become self and other. That interaction leads to step seven, feeling, the immediate physical mental reactions to that interaction, which leads to step eight, craving and desire, which also includes dislike and aversion. This is the judgment based on the sensory experience and the feelings it has aroused. I crave experiences which reinforce and aggrandize the self, and I dislike and fear that which might diminish it. Craving and desire lead to step nine, grasping or avoidance, the direct action in response to the judgment of number 8, which leads to step 10, becoming. The constant actions of grasping and avoidance is the constant becoming, the business of just going on and on and on. One could say that steps 8 and 9, the craving and the grasping, provide the energy that powers number 10, the becoming. This whole thing is sometimes called the wheel of becoming, a seemingly insatiable desire to go on in whatever form that might take. The becoming leads quite naturally to step 11, birth or rebirth from the beginningless beginning. We just want to go round and round because we hate and fear the idea of stopping. Now, anything that is born must eventually die. So then we have step 12, old age and death. And we experience all the suffering that goes with. And all that suffering gives rise to and reinforces ignorance, and away we go on another round. All the teachings of the Buddha are cause and effect. The teaching of every religion that I have ever heard about is cause and effect. The entire scientific enterprise is an exploration of cause and effect. All that we learn in and out of school are matters of cause and effect. A child's first tentative steps into the world are lessons in cause and effect. But there is a particular view of cause and effect that can become an insupportable burden. How many times when something bad happens, we shrug and say, "It's my karma." All our suffering seems to be a matter of cause and effect. Preoccupation with cause and effect can lead to the most abject misery and guilt. Some years ago, there was a wonderful episode in the comic strip For Better or For Worse, in which a teenage boy tells his mother that he is gay. The mother immediately starts to rant and rave, "What did I do? Where did I go wrong?" Her son says, "Mom, it's not your fault. You can't blame yourself." And she yells back, "I've got to blame somebody!" The whole blame game is based on this particular notion of cause and effect. When bad things happen to us, our first question is usually, "What did I do to deserve this?" People diagnosed with cancer are often reluctant to tell anyone because of a secret feeling that it is somehow their fault. The same thing happens with victims of rape. "I must have done something wrong." In ancient China, diseases like leprosy and tuberculosis were considered karmic retributions for sin. Today, there are some who feel that AIDS is divine punishment for an unacceptable lifestyle. The other side of this cause and effect coin is hubris, a kind of arrogance. In this can-do society, we have an inordinate regard for our own power to change things, to make things happen. We all admire the self-made man or woman, those who have goals, set out a course in life, and achieve everything that they set out to do. Every self-help book and scheme advertised has the same message: be the captain of your fate. Do A and B, and C and D will happen. Guaranteed. Follow the instructions, and you will achieve happiness, health, wealth, a great sex life, inner peace, and of course, most important, fresh breath and thicker, fuller hair. If we invade Iraq, we will be greeted with candy and flowers, and the price of oil will drop to $20 a barrel. If we torture and kill enough people, imprison enough people without trial for long enough, we will achieve national security and domestic tranquility. Well, I think you get the idea. All of these examples of both of guilt and of arrogance, some of them admittedly facetious, constitute a trap we can fall into, either in predictions about the future or reconstruction of the past. And it is this fundamental misunderstanding of the true nature of cause and effect that, far from helping to diminish the role of ego in our lives, actually reinforces it. I call it the chain of events fallacy. Many, if not most of us, I suspect, have this kind of Newtonian billiard ball notion of how cause and effect works. A causes B causes C. Billiard balls striking each other in sequence. One ball rolling along strikes a second ball and causes the second ball to start rolling. It strikes a third ball, which then starts rolling, and so on and on. It's very logical, very simple, but it doesn't work. We see again and again the utter failure of this approach, and yet we persist in it, place total faith in it. Remember, the first step in this whole mess, the wheel of samsara, includes ignorance of the true nature of cause and effect. So this is now what we have to grapple with in order to get into this koan. To help us out, I once again call upon our 14th Indian ancestor, Nagarjuna. Let me say a little bit about him here at this point, because although he is in the ancestral line that we've just chanted this morning, his name doesn't come up much in the usual course of our Zen training. Nagarjuna's dates are uncertain, but he probably lived and worked during the second century of the Common Era. This was a time of tremendous philosophical and spiritual ferment in India, with hot debates going on between the traditional Vedic scholars of Hinduism and the relatively new upstart Buddhism. Nagarjuna is sometimes called the second Buddha because he provided so much of the intellectual basis of Mahayana Buddhism. He's a little bit like Buddhism's version of St. Thomas Aquinas. He is also referred to as Buddhism's greatest skeptic. When I read that, my initial reaction was, "Not while I'm alive." But, of course, I must defer to this towering intellect. Nevertheless, he's my kind of guy. I believe that in his understanding, he can certainly be compared with Dogen. But unlike Dogen, the somewhat reclusive poet and mystic, Nagarjuna was a hard-headed logician who apparently reveled in controversy, taking on all comers in debates on the fundamental nature of reality. I will be presenting here some quotes from Nagarjuna's verses on cause and effect, as well as paraphrase and summary of his views. If I get it wrong, please blame me, not the ancestor. But here is how he deals with the chain of events fallacy. He writes, "Ordinary people become like a wheel without rest. There is a sense of uncertainty. That is, while a wheel revolves serially, each point on the circumference following upon the preceding one, in the three spheres, i.e. our life in time and space, it does not happen thus. Therefore, uncertainty is indicated." Uncertainty is indicated. Any cause or combination of causes can lead to a myriad number of effects depending on the whole infinite panoply of causes and conditions at any particular moment. Rather than a turning wheel, think of a clock face where each number is connected by a line to all the other numbers. Then imagine not a two-dimensional clock face or wheel, but a three-dimensional sphere covered with an infinite number of points connected to every other point. And not only the surface of the sphere, but the interior is filled with an infinite number of points all connecting to each other. And then imagine that this sphere is constantly changing its shape like cosmic silly putty, and we begin to get an idea of the complexity of the matter. We can never be certain of exactly which causes or combination of causes and conditions lead to which effects or combination of effects, except in the most simplistic kinds of examples. A case or modern chaos theory predicts that things are unpredictable. Not that they are random or senseless or indeterminate, just that they cannot be predicted. Infinitesimal, undetectable differences in conditions lead to wildly differing, unpredictable effects. Thus, things like the weather, horse races, football games, the stock market, and any aspect of human behavior are inherently unpredictable, and yet we persist in the fantasy. A case in point is the current international hysteria over something called global warming. The global climate system is what is termed in science babble a coupled, nonlinear, chaotic system, impossible to predict with any accuracy beyond a few days. And yet, the output of simplistic computer models fed with biased and incomplete data have been embraced with a kind of religious fervor, the same kind of irrational faith shown by believers in systems for winning the lottery or making money on the horses. The business of trying to tease out a specific chain of cause and effect to account for our current predicament, misery, or happiness, or to try to construct a scenario of future events is a spectacularly futile exercise. But if that is the case, what is cause and effect about? How then do we govern our actions if we consider ourselves moral people? Well, we have to take an entirely different approach. The very first lines of the Dhammapada read, "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make the world. Speak or act with an impure mind, and trouble will follow you, as the wheel follows the ox that draws the cart." We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make the world. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. Notice, there are no stock market tips, no weather predictions, or advice on how to dress for success. What the Buddha says here is the spiritual equivalent of water flows downhill. We all know that. But we still cannot predict the exact course a river will take as it floods and recedes, moves its banks, builds and rebuilds islands and sandbars over the years. The spiritual and moral implications are clear. You cannot base decisions on results or expected results. There is no predicting how any particular action will turn out. Therefore, it is only out of our own spiritual practice and deep awareness in the moment that such decisions and actions can arise. We sometimes sneer at an idealistic action that seems totally futile. What a dreamer. That will never stop the war, end poverty, end homelessness, and so forth. But we see that results-oriented thinking comes from the mistaken notion of cause and effect, the chain of events fallacy. All we can really know is that water flows downhill. We can't predict the course of the river. All we really know is that with our thoughts we make the world. We cannot predict what or how or when. In the book Ehe Dogen, Mystical Realist, Professor Kim writes, "The original intention of dependent origination was not to probe into the process or causation of origination, so much as it was to envision the state in which all the conditions and forces of the world were functionally interdependent. The idea of dependent origination was not a theoretical explanation, but a religious vision." A religious vision. The Buddha taught cause and effect not as strategy or tactics, but as spiritual practice. I think that this is, for many of us, the most difficult aspect of carrying our practice into the marketplace. That is to accept that the calculus of gain and loss, benefit or harm, good or evil, based on past performance, theoretical models, or expected results, is useless. And to do the right thing without knowing or even trying to guess how it may or may not turn out, to have no expectations whatsoever. Nagarjuna's dialectic continues here. He writes, "The 12 constituents," that's the 12 steps of the cycle, "do not originate from causes like space, primordial matter, natural order, spirit, nor through dependence upon other, God, time, intrinsic being, chance, circumstance, free will, and so on. They are interdependently originated, as the roof beams of a house depend upon one another." No rolling wheel here. Everything depends upon everything else in this moment. Cause and effect. If this is, that is. If this is not, that is not. Notice the use of the present tense. It doesn't say, if this was, that is or will be, or if this was not, that is not. For the effect to be present, the cause must be present. It's amazing how easily we lose sight of that fact. To return to our billiard ball model for a moment, there is a built-in assumption that once the collision has occurred, that the cause, i.e. the collision, is ended. And the effect, the second ball rolling, continues. But this is not the case. As causes continue and change, so does the motion of the billiard ball continue and change. But the causes must continue as long as the effect is to continue. Cause and effect must be congruent in time. What would happen if something existed after the cause had ceased? That would be the equivalent of saying that it had acquired a being in and of itself apart from cause and effect. But being apart from cause and effect, we would have no way of interacting with whatever event we're talking about. We would not be affected by it or have any effect upon it. We would not see, hear, taste, smell, touch, or even conceive of its so-called existence. So the whole notion of something outside of cause and effect is completely irrelevant to human experience. It's the sort of question the Buddha refused to have anything to do with. The most fundamental teaching of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, are themselves based on continuing causes and continuing effects. If a cause is discontinued, then so must the effect. The whole point of our practice is to identify and let go of the causes of suffering. If an effect continued after the cause ended, then that effect would be a phenomenon without cause. There is suffering. That suffering has a cause. If the cause is extinguished, then the suffering is extinguished. If that were not the case, if suffering were to continue even after the cause is extinguished, what is the point of practice? The same is true of space. Any physicist will tell you there is no such thing as action at a distance, in spite of what certain New Age psychics would have you believe. Cause and effect must be congruent in space as well as time. Why am I sitting about 6 inches above the floor right now? There's a ton under me. If it were here yesterday, or even a few seconds ago, but was not now, would I still be 6 inches off the floor? I don't think so. If the ton were at the other end of this room, would I be 6 inches off the floor? You'll forgive me if I don't demonstrate. Cause and effect are not connected because they were never separate in the first place. Cause and effect are one and the same. Nothing is transmitted. Not a particle, not energy, not process. There can be no separation whatever. No single thing can possibly have any sort of independent existence. Therefore, all causes and all effects are empty of any enduring self. They are empty and they are one. What we normally see as cause and effect is just the way in which empty oneness manifests. Either way, it is our true nature. Thus, Nagarjuna's analysis brings us to exactly the same point as Sher Do in Identity of Relative and Absolute, the verse that we recite during Sesshin. So, Baizhang the First asks Baizhang the Second, does an enlightened person fall under the law of cause and effect or not? It's a non-issue. It's like asking, is the enlightened person free of Buddha nature? Can water be free of wetness? Can I be free of my own true self, and why would I want to be? The question makes no sense. As for the answer, the enlightened person does not evade cause and effect. Well, no, of course not. In fact, it is our practice to pay the closest possible attention to that which is, and that which is cause and effect. It's a strange irony, but in some backhanded way, Baizhang I was right. You can be free of cause and effect, not by not falling under it or by evading it, but by practicing it, by being it. Then you are free. Not from, but as cause and effect. When we practice, move. When we breathe, one. When we just sit, we are practicing cause and effect. Also, when we walk, talk, care for children, or shop at Safeway. Nagarjuna writes, the whole world is cause and effect. Excluding this, there is no sentient being. Each cause, if you can still say that, gives rise to an infinite number of effects in this moment. Each cause is an infinite number of effects. Each effect is produced by an infinite number of causes in this moment. Each effect is an infinite number of causes. the cause of the me that sits here, and you, and you, and you, are all the myriad things, the universe. The effect of the me that sits here, and you, and you, and you, are all the myriad things, the universe. All beings are like this. What then is the holy life? As we are the continuing effect of the myriad causes of the universe, how shall we receive? Everything that happens to us is a gift. Receive it with wonder and gratitude. As we are the continuing cause of the myriad effects of the universe, how shall we act? Everything we do is an offering made with mindfulness and compassion. When we lose ourselves in Zazen, we see all this. With every breathing of Mu, with every count of the breath, every moment of sitting, we enter more and more into cause and effect. There is nothing else. And the more clearly we see, the greater our care, our compassion, our gratitude, and our joy. Again, the Dhammapada. See yourself in others. Then whom can you hurt? What harm can you do? Let me presume to rephrase that a bit by stealing from Roshi. See yourself in all beings at this very moment, all that breathes and does not breathe. Then you can do no harm whatever, and all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.